Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, there are some books that don't just talk about history. They practically invent how we think about a whole era.
Yeah.
Today, we're really getting into one of those. Jacob Burckhardt's massive 1860 work, The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy.
That's a huge claim, but honestly, it's pretty accurate. Before Burckhardt, the Renaissance, people mostly saw it as, you know, a revival of classical stuff, art texts.
Right, like dusting off old statues.
Exactly. But Burckhardt comes along and says, no, this is fundamentally different. This is the birth of the modern mind. His book isn't really a story like A happened, then B happened. It's more like a brilliant detailed picture of a whole cultural spirit.
That really is key, I think. So Jacob Burckhardt, he's writing in Switzerland, mid-19th century. Nationalism is surging. Mass movements are starting up. What makes his perspective so, well, unique, especially when you think about his contemporaries, like Hegel, who were all about big political history, right?
Well, Burckhardt, he lived from 1818 to 1897. Mm-hmm. He was really a pioneer of what they call cultural history. He intentionally shifted the focus away from, say, battles and treaties.
Uh-huh.
He argued that the real history is in the spirit of an age, how people lived, what they valued, how they celebrated, how they thought. And, you know, he was pretty skeptical about where modern society, his own society, was headed. All that collective excitement. It made him look back at the Italian Renaissance and see this explosion of individualism, something he kind of admired, but also, frankly, feared a bit.
So he's looking at the past to make sense of his present, maybe even warn about the future. Okay, so that brings us right to the core idea, the big thesis for this whole deep dive. Burckhardt says the Renaissance wasn't just digging up old Greek and Roman things. It was revolutionary. It was the birth of the modern individual and the modern state. So our mission today is to unpack how he makes that case, how this period, according to him, completely broke from the medieval world.
And for Burckhardt, that break starts inside the head, with the melting away of what he famously called the medieval veil.
The veil, that sounds quite evocative. What was life like under this metaphorical veil? How did people see themselves?
Well, under that veil, consciousness was collective, pretty much entirely. You don't really think of yourself as, you know, a unique person with your own spirit and direction. You were defined by the group.
Like your family or your job.
Exactly. Your race, your family, your guild, the church's teachings. Your identity was kind of secondary to these larger things. The world was understood through these established frameworks, these authorities.
But Burckhardt argues that in 14th century Italy, something dramatic happened. This veil didn't just get thinner. It dissolved. Almost violently, you said. Does he really push for such a sudden break? I mean, didn't monasteries keep classical learning alive through the Middle Ages?
That's a totally fair point. And yeah, historians have definitely pushed back on the abruptness. But for Burckhardt, the psychological shift felt revolutionary, sudden. The moment someone realizes, hold on, I'm not just a piece of this group. I'm self-aware. I have potential, ambition, my own thoughts. That, for him, was the crucial break. This awakening, this individualism, it's the engine driving everything else. The politics, the art, the philosophy, it all flows from freeing the self.
And the way he structures the book really shows that, doesn't it? It's thematic, not just a timeline. Six parts, exploring different facets. And he kicks things off with politics, calling it the political crucible.
He almost had to start there because the political situation in Italy was unique.
Right.
It wasn't a unified country like France or England. You had this constant push and pull between the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire, which created this power vacuum.
Instability.
Exactly. Inherited titles didn't mean as much. Raw ambition, sheer ability that could get you power.
And out of that mess, he pulls one of his most famous ideas. The modern state, born in Italy, conceived as a work of art.
Yeah. That metaphor is so sharp. What he means is the state stops being this sort of organic thing, maybe ordained by God based on old traditions. Instead, it becomes a calculated, rational, designed thing,
yeah.
Like an artist or architect planning something based on function, on what works best. Rulers started using statecraft almost like high-level management and PR.
And the examples he uses really hammer this home.
Yeah.
You mentioned those calculating despots like Francesco Sforza in Milan.
Yeah.
He was a condottiere, right? A mercenary captain who basically just took over the duchy because he was smart and ruthless enough to do it.
Precisely. He wasn't claiming divine right. He was claiming, I can run this place better.
Yep. Competence.
Competence. And then you look at Florence, Burckhardt sees it as this buzzing political lab, constantly trying new forms of government, debating laws, analyzing how power actually works. Even the popes, after they came back from Avignon, they ran their own territories, like secular princes, building armies, collecting taxes, making treaties. Ruthlessly practical. This whole environment, this insecurity and constant competition, it forced people to rely on their own abilities. What the Romans called virtu.
Virtu. Personal strength, capability.
Yeah.
So that's the political spark. And it leads right into the heart of the book, doesn't it? This newly self-aware individual.
It really does. Burckhardt famously calls the Italian the firstborn among the sons of modern Europe. And what drives this new person? A burning, almost secular desire for fame fama, they called it, and earthly glory. It wasn't all about getting into heaven anymore. It was about making your mark here and now.
Okay, but how does he show this shift wasn't just happening among rulers? What cultural evidence points to this radical individualism taking hold?
He looks closely at new kinds of writing that emerged. Sure, there's the rise of modern biography describing people's lives in detail, but even more telling for Burckhardt is the boom in autobiography.
People writing about themselves.
Yes, think about Benvenuto Cellini's autobiography. It's just overflowing with swagger, self-promotion, detailed stories of his own genius and adventures. Writing your own life story with that level of introspection and, let's be honest, self-obsession, that was pretty new. The individual becomes the main character.
And the peak of this self-awareness, this drive, is the ideal of the uomo universal, the all-sided man, the Renaissance man.
Leon Battista Alberti is Burckhardt's prime example here. This guy was an architect, a top athlete, a musician, wrote moral philosophy, art theory. I mean, he did everything. Alberti embodied this radical new belief that human potential was basically limitless. If you had the drive, the awareness, the education, you could master almost anything. It's like the ultimate expression of meritocracy based on talent.
Okay, now we have to address the classics.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is where Burckhardt kind of flips the usual story. If the individual was already waking up, what role did rediscovering ancient Greece and Rome actually play?
Right, this is crucial. Burckhardt says antiquity wasn't the cause of the Renaissance spirit awakening. It was a tool that the already awakened spirit reached for.
A tool? How so?
Well, these newly self-aware individuals, they were looking for models. Models for how to live an excellent life in this world, an active secular life. The medieval mindset didn't really offer that in the same way.
So when someone like Petrarch gets obsessed with studying Cicero, he's not just admiring the Latin, he's looking for a blueprint for how to be an engaged citizen and intellectual in the world.
Exactly. Burckhardt's point is that the revival was necessary because this new kind of individual needed the language, the forms, the whole secular worldview that antiquity offered. It helped them articulate this new sense of self they were feeling. It was a conscious choice, an adoption, not just finding old scrolls. And this new way of looking at things, this objectivity, it expands both outward to the world and inward to the self. This is what he calls the discovery of the world and of man.
So outwardly, the world itself becomes something to be studied objectively, mm-hmm. not just interpreted through theology.
Precisely. You see the beginnings of modern cartography, a real passion for geography, for travel descriptions. And look at paintings, landscapes stop being just symbolic backdrops. They become detailed, observed studies of nature itself.
And inwardly, the discovery of man.
That leads to this incredible new psychological depth. Think about portrait painting. It's not just about showing someone's status anymore. Artists try to capture the inner life, the personality, the mood. And in writing, humanist histories and character sketches start digging into people's motivations, their complexities, with a sharpness that feels really modern. They're starting to see themselves and others as complex psychological beings for, like, the first time.
And as this way of thinking spreads, it starts changing society itself, right?
Yeah.
Let's touch on the society and festivals part. Individual talent starts to matter more than just your family name.
Oh, absolutely. The status of the artist, the scholar, the skilled administrator, it shoots way up. Talent and wealth could open doors that were previously closed by birthright alone. And this new dynamic society needed ways to show off its power and talent. That's where festivals come in.
Right. Those incredible public festivals, the carnivals. They sound like fun, but Burckhardt saw them as more than just parties, didn't he? Like serious tools of power.
Definitely political statements. These weren't just spontaneous blowouts. They were highly planned, very elaborate, almost like moving works of art, as he put it. Rulers used them deliberately to project an image of power, wealth, order, legitimacy. It was applying aesthetic design to the job of governing, which is a very Renaissance idea.
But this whole explosion of culture, driven by individual ambition, it leads us to the final section, which is maybe the toughest, morality and religion. Because all that freedom came with a dark side, a cost.
It absolutely did. When the old medieval structures of authority broke down and personal achievement became the highest goal, traditional morality often took a hit. Burckhardt is very clear about the duality here. The same freedom that allows Leonardo da Vinci to flourish also creates space for, well, real depravity.
The genius and the monster side by side. And he uses Cesare Borgia as the ultimate chilling example of ambition without limits.
Cesare Borgia is like the terrifyingly logical endpoint of this age, in a way. He wasn't driven by wild passions, Burckhardt argues. He was driven by cold, hard calculation, utterly ruthless, focused only on the goal, operating as if the ends always justified the means, completely free from old moral rules. The big takeaway there is that when you unleash radical individualism, you also risk unleashing radical, well, license. Anything goes.
Okay, so we've gone through this deep dive into Burckhardt's vision of this psychological earthquake. If we had to boil it down, what are the two absolute core takeaways that make this book still so important today? Let's start with the secular shift.
The secular shift is huge. It's that fundamental move away from a worldview totally centered on the afterlife, on salvation, which was the medieval focus towards pursuing things in this life. Earthly fame, recognition, human knowledge, achievement. You could argue we live in a fundamentally secular world today because of the groundwork laid back then.
And the second big one is maybe Burckhardt's method itself, the unity of culture. He forces you to see how everything is connected, the politics, the art, the parties, the morals, the education. They're all just different expressions of the same underlying cultural spirit. You can't fully grasp one without looking at the others.
Which flows right into the real life applications for anyone listening today. First, it really pushes you towards holistic thinking.
Seeing the connections.
Exactly. Stop putting things in neat little boxes. If you want to understand, say, today's political climate, Burckhardt would tell you to also look at our technology, our art, our social values, because they're all interconnected, all part of the same cultural moment.
And the second application feels incredibly relevant right now in our age of influencers and startups and disruption. It's the cautionary tale on ambition. Burckhardt definitely celebrates the freedom that lets genius bloom. But the book is also a stark reminder, isn't it? That freedom and power demand responsibility. It shows us what can happen when ambition gets completely disconnected from any kind of ethical anchor.
Yeah, that tension really struck me rereading it. The birth of the modern self, which this book basically maps out. We're still grappling with that core conflict he identified. How do you balance the individual drive that fuels progress and creativity with the shared ethics you need for a decent society?
For me, what really sticks is that idea of the state as a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a powerful metaphor and surprisingly timeless. It's a lesson in leadership, really. Whether you're talking about a 15th century despot or a 21st century CEO, that deliberate crafting of an image, applying design and story to power, it's still absolutely critical for success, isn't it?
It really is. How things look, the narrative you build it, was as important then as it is now.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.